bless you. The theme of my praise is to bless you, Lord. The theme of my praise is to bless you. All of the rest of my days, the theme of my praise is to bless you. The theme of my praise is to bless you, Lord. The theme of my praise is to bless you. All of the rest of my days, in a thousand ways, I will bless you all of my days. In a thousand ways, I will give you blessing and praise. The theme of my praise is to bless you. The theme of my praise is to bless you, Lord. The theme of my praise is to bless you. All of the rest of my days, the theme of my praise is to bless you. The theme of my praise is to bless you, Lord. The theme of my praise is to bless you. All of the rest of my days, in a thousand ways, I will bless you all of my days. In a thousand ways, I will give you blessing and praise.
Hi, in this series, Reverend Dr. Nixon de Vera will be reading his book, Constructing Eschatology, Rethinking the Prophecy in Isaiah, to delve into who God is and what God is capable of, considering life in general, especially in your life. Questions like, to what extent God has foreordained things, specifically before and during the final day of judgment. The author thinks all that concerns God's majestic plan, that is, to accomplish God's purpose for humanity, is covered in its entirety. In short, God is highly active in foreordaining things, and whatever God foreordains shall be fulfilled in the end. There will be intermission songs in between readings, courtesy of the Haven of Rest Quartet. Let us now hear from Nixon.
Chapter 1. Unseen Compassion. Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. Isaiah 6 verse 3. This chapter explores the predictive declarations of the prophet Isaiah concerning the people of Israel. It will be argued that despite the confusions inherent in Isaiah about God's dealing with Israel, there is a way to conceive God as the one who foreordains in love. To support this, I will begin with pericopes in the first 12 chapters of Isaiah, in which the concepts of foreordination and divine love appear. Principally, the chapter is concerned with the following questions. Is God truly sovereign in the affairs of Israel? Also, to what extent can this sovereignty be applied to the fall of Zion? To what degree might this sovereignty represent God's love, notwithstanding the seemingly predetermined captivity and exile of the Jews? In response, the following will be examined. The prophet's warning of invasion and destruction in view of foreordination. The relation of divine judgment to divine compassion in light of the covenant with Israel. Judgment as contributory to God's healing. And Jerusalem as the locus of eschatological hope for humankind. Let us now turn to the first section of Isaiah with the emphasis on God as sovereign. Summary of Isaiah 1 to 12. This section focuses on the prophet's vision of judgment and hope for Jerusalem. It begins with the accusation of the leaders of Jerusalem for insurrection through idolatry and injustice. Here the sovereign God was about to judge the city by sending heathen nations to conquer Israel. According to Isaiah, the judgment would be like a purifying fire that burns away all dross in Israel to give way to the new Zion. The remnant would populate the new Zion. When all nations heard about the kingdom of God and learned justice and righteousness, they would come to the temple in Jerusalem. This ushered in the age of universal peace and harmony. At the outset, the storyline of the transformation of old Zion into the new Zion is repetitive throughout Isaiah, but rendered with increasing detail. In the middle of the section, the prophet sees God through a vision, sitting on his glorious throne in the heavenly temple, and strange creatures around the throne shouting, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord." While in awe, the prophet suddenly realized how corrupt he was, by extension, Israel. He was sure that God's holiness would destroy him, yet fortunately, such holiness, depicted by a burning coal, burned Isaiah's filth instead, not his body and soul. That demonstrated the purification of his sin applicable to Israel too. With this thought, the prophet was encouraged to keep announcing the coming judgment because of the purification that came with it. Notably, Israel had reached a point of no return in which the prophet's warning was to have a paradoxical effect of hardening the people. Nonetheless, such hardening is part of the Lord's master plan. It was about to be chopped down like a tree and left like a stump in the field. In due time, the stump would be burned, but after burning, God declared that this smoldering stump would be a holy seed that would survive into the future. This was a beacon of hope. But who was the holy seed? The holy seed, Isaiah predicted, was David's descendant, a king of Jerusalem. Yet the seed would arrive after the sack of Jerusalem. God would raise Assyria to chop down Israel by devastating the land, and that was not the end of it. In fulfillment of the promise to David, the beacon of hope would reign afterward as the king of the new Jerusalem. The king would also be called Emmanuel, God with us, and his kingdom was to free Israel from the shackle of the imperial overlords. Hence, Israel was the small shoot coming out of the smoldering stump. Crucially, the shoot likewise represented the coming of the holy seed stemming from the old stump of David's family. King Emmanuel of the New Jerusalem would rule by the Spirit of God to bring justice and righteousness, not only for the abused Jews, but also for all distressed peoples. An eschatological hope prefaced the dominion of the Messiah. His kingdom would transform all creation, bringing everlasting peace and harmony. The prophet finished the section with a message of judgment and hope.
Great is the Lord, he
holy and just. By his power we trust in his love. Great is the Lord, he is faithful and true. By his mercy he proves his love. Great is the Lord and worthy of glory. Great is the Lord and worthy of praise. Great is the Lord, now lift up your voice. Now lift up your voice. Great is the Lord, is the Lord, is the Lord. Great is the Lord. Great is the Lord, he is holy and just. By his power we trust in his love. Great is the Lord and worthy of praise. Great is the Lord, now lift up your voice. Now lift up your voice. Great is the Lord, is the Lord, is the Lord. Great is the Lord. Great is the Lord, is the Lord, is the Lord. Great is the Lord, is the Lord.
After summarizing the first section of Isaiah, we will now investigate how and why invasion and destruction is what God had foreordained. God as sovereign. In Isaiah, there is only one master of Israel, the Lord God. The prophet writes, "Therefore, says the Sovereign, the Lord of hosts, the Mighty One of Israel, I will pour out my wrath on my enemies and avenge myself on my foes. I will turn my hand against you. Afterward, you shall be called the City of Righteousness, the Faithful City." Isaiah 1:24-26. What does it mean for God to be sovereign? The being of God is in conjunction with the adjectives belonging only to God. One of the approaches in conceiving God is in terms of God's self, that is, a category of its own, sui generis, in relation to time. It is foundational in the doctrine of God to view God as unbound by time and non-contingent to time. God is sovereign before time, in time, and after time. God transcends time, but he chooses to associate it with himself. God, therefore, is a being outside as well as inside time, distinct from human beings. That means God can exist without time, impossible to any created being. Anything created has a beginning, so whatever is created has an end. In contrast, God has no starting point. Since God has no endpoint, this captures the character of the Alpha and Omega. In being so, God is the Mighty One. God reveals and implements what he has foreordained for Israel, unswayed by human decisions. In this foreordination, negative prophecy is unavoidable. Hence the expression, I will turn my hand against you. Mortification. No doubt, God was behind the downfall of Israel. Nonetheless, in examining the prophecy, the no serves the yes. The I will, negative, leads to the you shall be, positive. God, in his might, causes all things necessary for Israel and his neighbors too. World powers are subservient only to the power of God. The recurrent striking healing of God makes Zion the city of righteousness. Consecration. The effectiveness of this system arises from God's selfless character. God does not shy away from involvement in the misery of Israel. And more importantly, God justifies his actions. As divine sovereignty unfolds in eschatology, it is rational to presuppose that the end of the history of Israel reflects the end of the history of humanity. This is made possible in the reign of King Emmanuel. This king rules by the Spirit of God with justice and righteousness, not only for the abused Jews, but for all distressed peoples too. Such eschatological hope signals the dominion of the Messiah. The Messianic kingdom would one day transform all creation, bringing everlasting peace and harmony. The Lord is not, in the Platonic sense, in which God, transcendent, cannot be amongst the non-God, immanent. That which is divine cannot be human. In Isaiah, however, the things in heaven can also be on earth. This is somehow expressed in Isaiah. But as Robin Parry elucidates, it is impossible to tell. The lines between the two are very blurry at times, because the earthly temple functioned as a gateway to heaven. In this observation, God becomes creator creature as God becomes divine human. The antecedent assumed the consequent, manifested in the prophesied Messiah, Jesus Christ. Furthermore, the divine rules over the human. This is not reversible. How can something temporal, by necessity, be above time? There is a great irony in thinking that someone limited by time, by force, can genuinely control what is in time. God, in time, though uncoerced by it, administers humans. If one presupposes that humans, in some ways, have a hold of the divine, that is idolatry. Here, the divine, arguably, is an imaginary god, a delusional god. We deal with the creator god, one who wills to be in time. The creator god in the beginning, in self-existence, God made all things exist. Suffice it to say that there is none like him. In other words, the creator is sovereign in managing the creation, the non-god and the anti-god. That is vital in understanding divine sovereignty. If one misses who God truly is and what he is capable of, then distortion of God is expected. For instance, God is seen as aloof, distant from creation, and has nothing to do with the actual happenings in the world. Such a deistic view of the creator God compares God to a watchmaker. For the earth runs like an automatic watch, as the cosmos functions with a very reliable operating system. God is understood to relegate the management of the world to human beings. Hence, the sovereign one becomes an observer. Nonetheless, the prophet confirmed that this is not the God of Israel. God is busy mending Jerusalem. Put into words, I will. The rebellious city is meant to be the faithful city, the wellspring of eschatological hope, mission. God is highly active in managing the world and all human affairs. Whatever God has begun, God will bring into completion. So when God created heaven and earth, these were considered very good in the Bible. Yet, it does not mean that creation can sustain itself apart from God. Creation was, is, and will be fully dependent upon its creator for its continued existence and prosperity. Since God is like a parent, he rules with warmth. This is reflected in a mother's compassion for her child, motivated by pity and mercy. Such compassion is the first and foremost character of God associated with himself in passing before Moses on Mount Sinai. The Creator God, however, is very unlike the mother in the animal world. When the mother eagle is assured that her fledglings can fly, she will then leave them. God will never ever leave behind what he created. In reality, without God, creation stops existing. God does not abandon creation in time immemorial and will continue to keep it in eternity. The God of the eternal past, eternal now, and eternal future is the same caring and sustaining deity. Sovereign over Israel. A few generations after creation, God chose the descendants of Abraham to be the people of God. We know that later on, these people were called Israelites and live in Canaan. It is clear in the Bible that daughter Zion is God's elect. Here we can see that the one who does not need time comes into time and works through those in it. Israel is elect, and so the prophet Isaiah is to make God known to all peoples. Karl Barth says that Isaiah's calling is on a much grander scale compared to the calling of Moses because of the way God introduced himself. God revealed himself to the prophet in the heavenly temple. God revealed himself to the lawgiver in the burning bush. But much more important, Barth continues, is that which is shown to Isaiah constitutes a historical declaration which goes beyond what is previously made. Barth is right that Isaiah seems to have been summoned more impressively than Moses. They, however, are somewhat equal in terms of eschatological significance given Moses' presence at the Transfiguration. It means that his calling bears significant weight as it is connected to the Messiah. Moses was there talking about Jesus' departure from the world that was about to happen in Jerusalem, an act that would deliver the promised glory to Israel. The Shekinah, the settling of divine presence, is what the prophet referred to. Its implication for humankind is profound due to its universal coverage. It is asserted that the doctrine of election ties in with that of divine sovereignty. How God rules, how God demonstrates his power, how he cares for the people are the interests here. Israel is chosen to accomplish God's purpose on earth. This is why Israel is under God's sovereignty.
Thanks for joining us and wish you could be with us next time in our series on Constructing Eschatology, Rethinking the Prophecy in Isaiah. Until then.
I cast all my cares upon you. I lay all of my burdens down at your feet, and any time that I don't know just what to do, I will cast all my cares.